does not observe Torah mitzvahs, and normally we go to secular court, and they only go to Beis Din because in this particular case they figure that the halacha is going to favor them. So then the Beis Din is not obligated to utilize halacha in order to adjudicate the case. Then you can invoke the principles of civil law if this is what the person generally relies upon, and they're only running to Beis Din because in this case they think it's going to be advantageous to them to follow the halacha. Assuming that there wouldn't be any violation of ritual law in the process, as we mentioned, that a Beis Din is never allowed to paskin that it's permissible to collect interest from somebody, for example. But if it's a monetary matter, and normally there's one halacha that applies, but people could make a condition between themselves to follow a different scheme, so then Beis Din can say that if that scheme is consistent with secular law, and that's what's fair and just and equitable under the circumstances, then that's the law that can be applied to adjudicate the case. It's a good question. Okay, I think that brings us to 8:45, so now we can officially begin. And they turn down the case. Beis Din generally is not supposed to turn down cases. We have a principle, lo sagui mipneish, that if Beis Din is never supposed to be intimidated, shall we say, by the type of case or by the parties, so Beis Din should hear everything. However, Beis Din does have the right to say that in certain cases, we think that the better result will be achieved by sending the parties to secular court. And when Beis Din does that, then it's not considered as if there's a violation of going to secular court, because then the secular court is viewed as the agents of the Beis Din, since the Beis Din is the one who directed the case to be heard over there. So that can sometimes be done. I think there's a tshuva of the smak, of the Sefer Mitzvos Katan, that essentially says that. The author, the Mechaber of the smak, has a tshuva in which he indicates as much. It's quoted by a Rabbi Sha'anan, who's a Dayan in Eretz Yisrael, so he published an article in Tehumen in which he quotes the smak. First he quotes the Maram Mewittenberg, but then he points out the Maram Mewittenberg could be construed or interpreted a different way depending on your girsa. So he comes up with a smak which unequivocally makes this point. Okay.
At that point, though, I mean, certainly there are people that the Beis Din knows are troublemakers, the Beis Din doesn't want to get involved in a troublemaker. Or they'll just,
technically speaking, the halacha that Beis Din is not allowed under any circumstances to turn away a case is when the case has already begun in Beis Din, and Beis Din already has figured out lahechan adin nota, already knows in which direction the case is heading. So at that point, it's an absolute prohibition. But otherwise, if Beis Din is fearful for their lives, if they get a deal with a particular personality, then they do have the right to decline the case from the very beginning. It's like the Mexican mafia murder mystery case that I told you about, that we had at the Beis Din in New York, where I got suddenly very uncomfortable when a case was referred to us by some Brooklyn Beis Din and said, we'd like you to take care of it. Somebody died. And it's a Mexican shtiebel, and he's the shamish, and he was holding money for people, and we have to figure out there's only so much money left over, and a lot of people who deposited money, we have to figure out how much money goes to each person, and we need somebody very knowledgeable and sophisticated and intelligent to handle the case, and I feel only you can do it. So flattery will get you everywhere. So I said, okay, sure, by all means, that's what we're here for, because we're so great, so of course we'll handle this case. And then I had all of these people calling me. I had like maybe 50 people call me over the next 2 weeks about how their life savings were invested in this person. Suddenly they died. It was under suspicious circumstances. The person died. It wasn't just stam, the person died of a ripe old age, and I realized that I was in over my head, and I didn't want to be driven under the ground. So as a result, I called up this rabbi in Brooklyn, and I said, thank you very much for the reference, but I think that this is actually beyond our expertise after all. Don't think that we can handle this. So sometimes we have to turn away a case. But there was a separate reason to turn away that case, like I mentioned a number of weeks ago, which is that nowadays Beis Din only has jurisdiction over civil cases, over monetary cases, but not over criminal cases. So when I felt that there were criminal overtones to the case, I felt this is surely beyond our jurisdiction. Those types of matters have to be handled over to the criminal authorities. That's why Beis Din generally can't hear claims for child molestation, because they involve criminal determinations, and Beis Din doesn't have that type of jurisdiction. If, for example, there was already a determination that somebody was a child molester, and now the people who are molested are making a claim with respect to all of their medical bills and all the therapy that they have to pay, but the Bezdin's not being asked to adjudicate whether there was molestation, whether there wasn't molestation, so then, since that's only a monetary claim, a Faripoy, for example, so Bezdin would be able to adjudicate that, but to get involved in the initial determination, which has criminal implications, so that's really beyond the jurisdiction of Bezdin nowadays. So Bezdin has to know the limits and the parameters of its jurisdiction. So this takes us back to some degree to Hasagas Gvul, to unfair business competition, which we were discussing last week, and which we will continue to discuss this week. So one of the questions about unfair business competition, I think that I mentioned, is that if you would go and bring such a case in civil court, that your business is being threatened because somebody else opened up a competing business, so I mentioned they would laugh you out of the courtroom, and that's one of the reasons why this is the type of case that even people who, as Dr. Shapiro mentioned, might not otherwise go to Bezdin, it might not otherwise be so observant, would bring this type of claim only in Bezdin, because they know there's not a chance in the world that they could prevail upon such a claim in a civil court. But does this have other ramifications as well? Do we say that because of that reality, that somehow this falls under the rubric of Dina de Malchusa Dina, that if the civil courts feel so strongly about free enterprise, so let's say that we have a more restrictive definition of a free enterprise, like we mentioned last week, based on the Avi Yosef, that the Avi Yosef says that if you're definitely going to be taking away another person's livelihood by opening up a competing business and the products are homogeneous, it's just that you open up in a location where the customers are no longer going to have access to the other person's location, so he says that you can have a Hasagas Gvul claim. So let's say secular court would say no. Under no circumstances can you have a claim for unfair business competition. So do we say that the Bate Din nowadays are restricted from even adjudicating this claim when Halakha would allow it based on the Dina de Malchusa Dina? So some people were under the impression, I have not been able to confirm this by anything in writing, but some were under the impression that this was the opinion of Rav Soloveitchik, because apparently there was a pizza parlor dispute in Teaneck, New Jersey at one point in time, where one pizza owner wanted to challenge another pizza owner from opening up a competing pizza store in Teaneck, New Jersey. And they turned to Rav Soloveitchik. This is something recorded by Rabbi Chaim Jachter. He quotes Rabbi Yossi Adler from Teaneck as quoting Rav Soloveitchik. So I'm already three steps removed from the original quotation, as saying that there's no such thing in America as a Hasagas Gvul claim. You can't pursue such a claim in America. So they thought maybe this is because Rav Soloveitchik felt that it's included within the rubric of Dina de Malchusa Dina, and that's why the claim can't be registered. One could say, no, maybe the Rav had something else in mind. Maybe he had in mind that most businesses, even if Bezdin would say that Jewish customers should not frequent a second business, nonetheless, if civil law would allow the second business to open and for non-Jews to go to the second business. So what have you accomplished if you say that the Jewish customers can't go to the business? But that shouldn't apply to businesses that are only directed towards the frum community or towards the Jewish community, like a kosher pizza store. How often do you see non-Jews eating in a kosher pizza store? Every now and then you do. I'm sorry?
In France.
In France, maybe. Okay. But that's just nuts. The Jewish people aren't wearing yarmulkes because, you know, they get all the sfardim in France who don't wear yarmulkes. But I don't think that you necessarily see so many non-Jews in certain types of establishments like Judaica stores and things of that variety. But what would be the argument? So we have said that Dina de Malchusa Dina applies to laws of general sweeping economic regulation that the government really cares very deeply about. So is that true about antitrust laws? So we have to examine this a little bit. There were some antitrust laws that were established, many of them in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the Sherman antitrust law and the Clayton Act. So the Sherman antitrust law, which was established in 1890, said you can't have any conspiracies in restraint of trade. The Clayton Act outlawed predatory price cutting. So predatory price cutting, we know, is something which is prohibited according to halacha. So that's consistent. The halacha is consistent with the Clayton Act. What about the Sherman Antitrust Act? No conspiracies in restraint of trade. So I remember once that there was somebody who was calling up when I was the menahel of the Besdin in New York, and we charged a certain amount for a gittin. That every couple that would come for a get, so we charged a certain amount. You don't become millionaires by doing gittin, but you have to cover to costs and overhead, and the prices go up as time goes on. So there was a question. So every now and then we would raise the price. Maybe at one point it was $300,000, $350,000, $400,000. I think at one point it was something like $450. And one of the other Masadri gittin called me up and said, "I want to raise my prices. But I don't want to raise my prices unless everybody else raises their prices too, because then people are going to go price shopping, and I'll have a higher price and you'll have a lower price. So can we all agree together that we're going to raise prices to a certain amount?" So I said, "I don't know, I think it might violate antitrust laws." Is that a kid? Sometimes people don't realize what they might be doing. So if you say that you're going to restrain competition, not allow a certain store or not allow a certain restaurant to open, so is that potentially in violation? This, if it's an antitrust act, that's presumably something the government does care very deeply about. They wouldn't prohibit arbitration tribunals from adjudicating a case that had antitrust implications, but they would be very concerned that the antitrust laws would be adhered to in the determination that would be made by the arbitration tribunal. In fact, there are Supreme Court decisions. I found a couple, if anyone's interested, called Mitsubishi Motors. That's 19 Mitsubishi Motors. Mitsubishi Motors is an 11th Circuit decision of 1986. Well, no, I think it's a Supreme Court decision. And then there's another one called AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, 2001. These are both Supreme Court decisions. And they say that even antitrust claims can be submitted to arbitration, meaning that the Besdin doesn't have to be worried that it's handling the case. What it does have to be worried about is the way that it handles the case. It's not against the law for the case to be submitted to a Besdin, to an arbitration tribunal. So what we used to do in New York, when we would have Hasagas Gvul cases, in order to be sensitive to the Dina Malchus Dina issues, is we wanted to follow the halacha, but we also didn't want to do anything where the government would feel that we were in violation of, say, the Sherman Antitrust Act or the Clayton Act, because, number one, we didn't want to violate Dina de Malchusa. Number two, we didn't want to go to jail. For these, very practical and sensible reasons, we wanted to make sure that we were not violating the antitrust statutes. So what we used to do is that we would bring in a firm fellow who was an antitrust partner and a major New York law firm, Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. So we had a fellow who was an antitrust partner, and so we would bring him in. He was a Yodea Sefer, so he was a knowledgeable firm person. He wasn't a musmach, wasn't a rabbi, but he was firm, and he was learning. I think he had learned in Ner Yisrael, and we would have him sit on the cases so that the two other people who would be rabbis would figure out the halacha, and he would sit there and make sure that he also learned the halacha too. But he would make sure that there was no violation of antitrust laws. What's interesting is that sometimes the way it can play out in a Besdin proceeding is counterintuitive, because a Besdin, in order to stay out of trouble, might figure we're not going to issue a decision. We'll just work out a compromise between the parties, that the parties will agree that they're not going to compete against each other in terms of the prices, that they'll agree to set the prices at a certain amount. They'll agree to set the products at a certain amount, and they're not going to introduce a certain type of product or a certain type of service and so forth. And we'll just say that the parties agreed in this way. It won't be an actual determination or an imposition which is coming from the Besdin. This way we'll escape all liability. But that might be much worse. That may be much worse, because then you're facilitating a collusion. You're facilitating a conspiracy and a collusion, which is exactly what the statute says you have to not do. So it might be that it's much, much better. But the Besdin to say, it could be you didn't want to have any of these restrictions whatsoever, but Jewish law requires these restrictions. Some Jewish law requires the restrictions, and that's why they're doing it. So it could be that that works according to halacha, and it also works better, potentially. That's why you need an expert, an antitrust trust partner to review it. Could work better from the perspective of civil law as well.
Isn't that an agreement on restraint of trade?
No, as I said, it might be more of an agreement on restraint of trade if the parties are settled between themselves, as opposed to if it's imposed upon them by the Besdin. That's the point that I'm making, that it's sort of counterintuitive, but it might actually work out better that way. Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, is the view or the needs of actual and potential consumers taken into account in all of these things? Because from what it sounds like, you're only taking, let's say, the store owner's perspective on these things.
We said you have to take that into account. You have to take into account the consumer, because that's the Rimigash. So the Shulchan Aruch quoted the Rimigash. That's source 6. I included it in the materials this week as well, because it's such an important concept. Which is that you have to be concerned about the you have to be concerned about the lukukos that the it says hainu dafka this idea say we'll look at the first line yeshamahad bnei yir yochon limchos bnei yir acheres that which we sometimes allow restraint on trade or a prevention of competition hainu dafka b'delekha pseid lukukos that's only if the consumers are not going to lose out. So for example, where the products are basically homogeneous and they're being sold at basically the same price. So from the consumer perspective, there really isn't much of a difference whether you have one person selling the product or whether I have two people selling the product. So, right, so then so we were mentioning that one of the major defenses in the pizza parlor cases is that not every pizza tastes exactly the same. And some people might prefer the new store's pizza, and some people might prefer the old store's pizza. So that's also something that you have to take into account. You always have to take into account the lukuchos, whether by virtue of preventing the new business from opening or limiting the way the new business opens, whether the lukuchos, whether the consumers are losing out. They're also considered to be a party to the litigation, even if they haven't signed up for the litigation. They're an implied party to the litigation. So the same considerations that are applicable when it comes to business competition might be applicable to some degree when it comes to trademark and copyright laws. So I want to look at a new scenario. That's question number one from today's materials. And this is based on a case that actually came in front of the Besdin. I've changed the names to protect the innocent and the not so innocent.
Just a follow up on that question. A lot of the industrial structure of businesses or economics of study, there are, once you set up a certain thing, it actually encourages new innovations and changes. Does the Besdin take that into account? But which is difficult because you can't predict what the future will come there. But it's,
you have to take into account everything. Take into account also the fact that sometimes if I have a busy shopping center and there are more stores that open up of a certain type, so that increases business, it increases customer volume, it increases the general business activity to create what's called a business district. So you're creating a business district. I'm sorry?
Macy's and Gimbel's.
Okay, which, who's still around there? Macy's apparently had a very bad last quarter. I heard of the business news on the radio.
The whole industry.
Okay. All right. So here we have a Baal Tshuva learning program named DAS. Operates in Chicago, Illinois, and quickly earns a good reputation throughout the country, although most of the participants and programs are locally based. In the meantime, another Baal Tshuva yeshiva opens in Israel, which is also called DAS. And the founder of the Chicago program says, hey, what's going on over here? Argues that the Chicago program is in danger of losing participants and funding from donors and the like to the new institution because they'll confuse them. They already worked hard to get a good name, to earn a good name, and they are now losing some of that goodwill that they worked hard to cultivate to a new institution that's using the same name and doing the same things. It's not as if, you know, it's DAS and they're selling software. It's DAS, and they're also reaching out to a Baal Tshuva population, which will be taking advantage of their name and reputation. The founders of the Israeli program claim, hey, come on, they never heard of the Chicago outfit. We're the big leagues over here. You're just a small town Chicago. What do you have to do with us? And that the two programs are so dissimilar in scope and location that one is Israel, and they're drawing people from all over the place. And it's a yeshiva, as opposed to the Chicago entity, which is a learning program. Maybe they have a couple of classes at night, you know, every now and then. They'll have a Shabbaton, they'll have a program, but it's not a full-fledged yeshiva. That there is no way that people would confuse one with the other. So how should the Beit Din decide? So we had a case like this. The names were different, and the population they were serving was different, but otherwise very, very similar to this fact pattern. So here is the question of, does Beis Din recognize that there is any kind of an ownership in the name itself? Does this emerge from the Hasagas Gavul sources that we've looked at, that there would be some sort of a claim that one would be able to make based on the name? And are there any other, you know, considerations? It's interesting, you know, a related question is if somebody, for example, publishes a certain, you know, work, so do they have a copyright? You know, does Halakha recognize that a person can have a copyright that others shouldn't be able to, you know, benefit from their work within a certain period of time? Is there such a thing? So the Ksam Sofer says that there was such a minhag, there was such a practice that in order to encourage people to publish Svarim, that they would have a copyright, they would have an exclusive, that nobody else could publish the same type of sefer within a certain number of years. And they discuss, the poskim discuss, whether this has a binding effect from the standpoint of halacha. Some say, well, yes, because maybe we can't find the source, so we'll just come up with a catch-all source. You know, it says in the Torah, you should do what's good and right in the eyes of Hashem. And the Ramban says this is a catch-all phrase. The Ramban, in his Perush in Parshas Re, and that Torah and that pasuk says it's a catch-all phrase because the Torah can't like mention every single right and good thing you're supposed to do. So even if it's not specifically mentioned in the Torah, so it's included in Yasisa Yashav Yatov. So some say that's the source for copyright laws according to Halacha. And others say no, the source is Dina D'Malchus Adina, that you have to follow the law of the land. So that's a question, because we said that's only if they really care about it. But let's say within a certain community, people decided that they're not going to allow anything to be copyrighted because it violates Jewish law. So would the government come in and say, no, no, you must have copyrights? So they wouldn't necessarily do that. So it's not necessarily then a violation of Dina D'Malchus Adina the way that we interpreted it. We mentioned that Rav Henkin is of the opinion that sometimes a government has the right to make economic regulations so just so that society runs in an orderly fashion. In the event that you don't have a Beis Din infrastructure that's strong enough to do it on their own. And that also qualifies as Dina D'Malchus Adina. So some say that according to Rav Henkin, copyright law should certainly qualify as Dina D'Malchus Adina. But let's look at our own sources. So here, if you look at the Note of Yehuda, the Note of Yehuda says, let's put this in some type of a halakhic classification. Reuven, this is the first source. Reuven Kiber Perishal Sefer Nezikin. Reuven published a commentary on the Mishnayos of Nezikin and Kachim, and he went to a publisher, Shimon, and they made up a certain amount of money that Shimon would publish his book, and the book would have on the top of the page would have all of the Mishnayos written very, very nicely. I guess not only Mishnayos, so it's Gemaras. It would also have Gemaras together with Rashi and Tosfos, and then the commentary would be on the very, very bottom. So Shimon figured that not everybody really could care less about the Reuven's commentary, but they like the Gemara and they like Rashi and Tosfos. So I'll take this very nice typesetting of the Gemara and Rashi and Tosfos, and I'll sell it independently. And I'll sell it independently. And Reuven, you know, Shreit Chai V'Kayim, that here he spent all this time preparing the typesetting a certain way, and Shimon published it, and it's true he paid off Shimon, but nonetheless it was Reuven's hard work and creativity that created this typesetting. Now if he's going to use this to sell separate from Reuven's own sefer, so Reuven's work is going to go for naught, because the people who would have otherwise bought his commentary are going to buy this other edition without his commentary, and he's going to lose out. So the dispute was whether Reuven somehow loses his right to his product once he has given it over to a publisher, or whether Reuven can make some sort of a claim that he put in the work to devise, that he put in the creative work and energy and effort to devise this printing and this typesetting and this presentation of the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, and nobody else should be allowed to benefit from it. So the Note of Yehuda discusses this in the context of the sugya in the Gemara of Zenenev Zeh Lochaser, that if somebody else benefits from, let's say, your property, but you're not losing out, so there, it's not necessarily an actionable offense. But he comes to the conclusion that here, the person who put in the work on this creative product is losing out. So take a look at the second paragraph of the Nodza B'Yehuda. This is on page 2. It says, Amna Machara Yishuv, he says, after considering this carefully, Nira Shechayev L'Shalem Chelko. He thinks that the Shimon, the publisher, is obligated to pay off Reuven for using this product, because he says that even in a case where I have somebody living in my courtyard and I wasn't planning on renting out the courtyard, that's the famous Zenen and Vizel Bokhasir case, says if the person who lives there causes a damage or a loss to my courtyard, then he does have to pay me everything. That's the halacha in Shulchan Aruch. So look in the second line, four words from the end of the line. V'harei gam kan mechasro habe. So here as well, Reuven Shimon is causing Reuven to lose a lot. Why? Shimloya Shimon matpis sidarim alalu havushchichi v'kavtzu zvini al sefarah. If Shimon wouldn't have used Reuven's work, so Reuven would have been able to sell a lot more sefarim. Shafilu mishalo hayakona perusha l'chud. Even if people wouldn't have bought the sefarim for his commentary, they don't care so much about the commentary, but they care about what's on top. So people want to read the Gemara. Lilma mitochan Gemara and Pirush Rashi v'toisves. So they would have added a little bit more. They'll say, okay, so now I'll buy that. And I'll also pay a little bit extra to get the commentary of Reuven. Now that Shimon is publishing his separate work, so now there'll be these books are going to be much easier to obtain. And he'll be able to even buy it for a cheaper price because it doesn't come with the commentary, and therefore it's going to cause Reuven a loss, and Shimon is responsible to reimburse Reuven for that loss. So the Nodeh Behuda approaches this from the theory of Zenene, that somebody is gaining a benefit from your property and you're losing in the process, and therefore you have to be compensated. So the same argument can be made with respect to somebody who invests in a particular name, in a particular brand, and then somebody else is gaining an advantage from that name or brand and is potentially bringing a detriment to the individual who invested so much in creating this name or brand to begin with. Yes, I see I have a number of hands up. Yes.
Is this considered theft?
Is this considered to be theft? So that's a question. The Gemara in Kiddushin on Daf and Tes talks about ani hamanake v'resha zayis, that I have somebody who is going up on an olive tree and they're trying to knock down the olives so that they'll be able to eat the olives. Then somebody else sees, oh, these olives just fell off the tree, I'll eat the olives. So the Gemara indicates that's already on a level of theft because there was almost like an acquisition made by the person who's knocking on the olives on the top of the tree so that they'll be able to gain the olives. So you could say that maybe it's a form of theft, but the Nodeh Behuda doesn't seem to take that a particular approach. The one who does seem to take that approach is the Chasam Sofer. So let's move to the Chasam Sofer, which is the source on the bottom of the page, since you've raised the question. And before we look at the Chasam Sofer, we'll remind ourselves of what Rabbeinu Meir, the father of Rabbeinu Tam, said last week. He actually said it, even longer ago than that, but we reviewed it last week. So Rabbeinu Meir, the father of Rabbeinu Tam, had said, remember we had that interesting case in the Gemara, we're going to go back to the fish, okay? Because everything ultimately leads back to the fish. When it comes to the Sugya of Asagas Gvul, you have those fish, you dug him the Yavi Sira. The fish that already have cast their gaze on a fisherman's net, a fisherman spread his net, and now there are fish that spread their gaze on that fish, fisherman's net, and they're heading towards that net, and this fisherman is going to make a killing with the fish. He's going to be able to trap many, many fish in the net. But some other fisherman comes along and says, look at all these fish that are going, that are heading down the stream in this particular direction towards a fisherman's net, which is 100 yards away. I'll put my net 50 yards away, so all the fish will go into my net. So the Gemara indicated that you can't do that. Now, we had a whole question is that Gemara Halacha Lamaisa at the end of the day, once we rejected Rapuna's opinion, where Rapuna seemed to hold that one business can stop another business from opening up in the same neighborhood, and then in the end, we paskin like Rapuna Breit Rav Yoshua, who said that one business can't stop another business from opening up in the same neighborhood. So it could be that when you get to the end of the Gemara, we throw away the fisherman's net restriction as well and say, no, it's okay. If one fisherman casts his net, even though the other one had already cast his net, that would also be okay. Or do we say, no. This case is so egregious that it would be a problem. So many take the approach to say, no, this case is more egregious than your normal business competition case. But why? So Rashi said, because it's considered to be mazik, you're causing damage to somebody. But Rabbeinu Meir seems to say that there's an actual theft which is involved. So let's take a look. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines down from in source 3, the first source 3. I think I have two sources 3 for some reason. Omer Rabbeinu Meir, Ovisha Rabbeinu Tam, Temari B'dag Meis, this is the dead fish, Shekein Derech HaDayogim L'Hasim Mesudas Dag Meis, because the fishermen place a dead fish usually in their fisherman's net. V'adogim Misasim Sham Soviv, and the other fish go around, they all head towards they circle around the dead fish. Misasim Sham Soviv also a dog. V'kimen Shezeh Pirish Mitzudasa Tachila, and since this one had already spread out his fisherman's net and had the dead fish inside, in other words, he invested in the dead fish. Because of the dead fish that he had placed there, the other fish are circulating towards his net. So if somebody else now spreads his net to catch the fish that have gone in this direction, it's as if he's actually stealing from him. So if Sam Sofa takes that paradigm and he applies it to basically this same situation. You look in source 3. By the way, one is a very good article on this particular subject in which I took a number of these sources by Rabbi Jachter in his book Gray Matter. So if you look in source 3 over here, so the Ksam Sofer says that he's talking as well about somebody who published Piyutim. Piyutim, you remember how maybe when you were growing up, you used to say like Piyutim, like a yontiv, and like you get to the end of Ma'ariv Aravim, before you get to the bracha, there'd be like a paragraph that you would say, we call piyutim, you know? So in the good old days, so lots of that, we just say piyutim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, but it used to be like you'd have piyutim, yotzros, you'd have these things like the entire year. Now we've tremendously reduced the amount that we actually recite and show. People are just in a rush to get home, as a general rule, but the piyutim are very, very beautiful. And he put together the piyutim, and he translated the piyutim so everybody should understand them. You can turn the page to page 3 over here. So this is a very, very important service. It says the Ksam Sofer, we want to encourage people to put in the work and the effort to publish the piyutim, and with very clear vowelization and commentary and translation and all that. But he said that the person who published the piyutim was now being threatened by somebody else who was publishing pretty much an identical work, or taking his work and republishing it, in other words, saying he didn't write the piyutim, this person didn't write the piyutim, so he's just going to publish, we'll take the piyutim and publish them himself. So it says the Ksam Sofer, is this something which is permissible or not? So he says that this is since the first person had put in all the labor and the toil in typesetting and in writing very clearly and very meticulously the correct text of the piyutim. Look, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines from the bottom of the Ksam Sofer towards the end of source 3 on page 3. V'lama yehenu, why should others be allowed to benefit from the effort and the toil and the investment and the work product of this individual, Mashimsu, from his work product? He says this is like others benefiting from the dead fish that was put in the fisherman's net that is described by Rabbeinu Meir. You could say this is really much worse than a dead fish, because really anybody could access a dead fish pretty easily, but this is like somebody's work product that requires, a sort of even more creativity than a dead fish. So it's almost like a Kal Vachomer. If benefiting from somebody else's dead fish is a problem, so it's certainly a problem to benefit from somebody's creative effort and toil. Shehu atzai garm kibbutz hadagim. You have one fisherman who caused the fish to gather around, and therefore al kein yachiku sharet sayadim yichok parsa. And therefore, the other fishermen are supposed to stay away. They have to stay away a certain amount of distance. Vachinami kav the kavasei. He says, and the same thing should be true over here. That once the first person puts out his book of piyutim, then we have to prevent other people from being able to benefit from the publication of the piyutim in a way that's going to harm this individual. So Ksam Sofer is taking it even a step further, and it doesn't even sound like it's the same typesetting per se that the other person is utilizing, but the mere fact that this the first individual put in an effort into a certain work product, and that if others are going to be able to also get a hana from the from this enterprise, so that's going to discourage this person from putting in that toil and that effort and that creative energy. Yes.
So it seems like we're trying to draw a connection between the printer case and the Putin case to the trademark dot case.
Right.
The question is, in both Trump's over case and the note of view, suppose in a hypothetical case that the printer came up on his own with the same typesetting, right, without knowledge and all of this other Gemara format. And suppose in the Hassan Sofer case, the same thing, the Python came up with the same piyut without knowledge of the other party. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like both would hold that that would not be a problem, meaning that part of the issue that they're taking is the knowledge that they're taking it from someone else. But if they came up with the same creative idea, it's based on the language, certainly from the Noda Yehuda, it seems like he would have no issue with that.
I think certainly within the Noda Yehuda, the Ksam Sofer was justifying the notion of copyrights in general, but certainly the Ksam Sofer would be moda that that's an easier case, you know, to argue, namely when one person is clearly benefiting from the work product of another person, as opposed to they have two individuals who are both engaged in the same creative endeavor, you know, simultaneously at the same time. That's a much more difficult argument to make, because in the fisherman's net case, the fisherman's net was where the one fisherman had produced a certain work product, and the other fishermen are benefiting from his specific work product. Not that they're casting their own nets in the same seas, and some fish are going to go towards this nest, and some fish are going to go towards another nest, and there isn't enough fish for everybody, and that type of an argument. So I would agree with that.
But would that mean that in the Dodd case, it's a very significant question as to whether or not they knew of the Chicago...
I don't know about that, because let's say that in your example, let's say in the fisherman net case, that somebody spreads his net not knowing that somebody else had a dead fish over there, okay? And this person didn't have, a dead fish. They thought they had a dead fish, but it was really a live fish that's just like in bad shape. And therefore, it's not going to cause the other fish to swarm around. But unbeknownst to the second fisherman, the real reason that the fish are coming into his net is because there's a dead fish right next door, in the fisherman's net that's a few yards away from him. And since the fish are flowing in that direction anyway because of that dead fish, so therefore they see this net, so they're going into this net as well. They see this other fish that looks like it's in bad shape. They wouldn't have come to that fish to begin with, but now they're congregating towards that fish as well. So you could say it's more akin to that type of case, because who knows if the people would have gone to this second yeshiva that's called Das, if not for the fact that they had originally heard, there's a good yeshiva called Das, or there's a good program called Das for Baalei Teshuva. And look, here they have the Das right here in Israel. I think I'm going to go to this. So therefore, it's not that they're independently getting the value. So what a Beis Din would have to look at is sort of your question, that are the people going to the second yeshiva because of its own independently earned reputation? Are they going irrespective and irregardless of the fact that it has a name that's similar to the other one? Or is there some sort of name recognition that can reasonably be inferred that would already be out there with respect to the first place that's causing people to go to the second place on the basis of that reputation? So what the Beis Din did in this case was it compiled evidence, you know, like people who testified and said, yes, I went to this place because I really thought it was the same as this other place, and I discovered it was different, but you know what? It wasn't bad, so I decided to go there anyway, and I'm really happy that I went there. But they admitted that they had turned there in the first place based on the reputation of the other institution. Also, the Beis Din did an assessment of how many similar type institutions are there that are out there, there might be a proliferation of similar type names that it wouldn't really be of significance, or is this something which is like a big deal where, you know, the name really does have a tremendous significance because it's not something which is readily available? To what degree is the Chicago institution very, very localized and the other one, you know, more of a different type of institution? And to what degree do we say no? In our world, people travel back and forth between Chicago and Yerushalayim all the time, right? I mean, I'm planning to go next week. It's something which is very, very commonplace in our circles. So we came to the conclusion in the end that from the perspective of halacha, there really could potentially be some confusion. On the other hand, it really was innocent, right? It was innocent, and you can't necessarily penalize somebody for complete innocence. Do we say that innocence is a complete defense when it comes to Hasagas Gvul? So if you take a look at source number two...
Unimonotics could be talking about where you're not making any money, you're just simply taking or benefiting from the personal investment of the person.
That's right.
Whereas here, aside from the fact that they invested the time, he's actually taking and harming his business. So the case of the Dot, they're actually harming Dot by going ahead and steering away business they would have had coming to them, regardless of whether it's
Yeah, again, Rebbeinu Meir is not specifically referencing Ani Amnake for Rosh Hazayis, but, you know, that's the sugya that yields this discussion. I mean, the halakhic case that he's referring to is the one of the businessman, of the fisherman, businessman. So that's the reason why he references that case. So on that Gemara that deals with Ani Amnake, the Gemara there also deals with the lower level of Ani Amahapech B'Charora, right? The poor person who's trying to eat a cookie, somebody else grabs the cookie, not very nice. So we say that's just considered to be a nasty thing to do. Again, there isn't necessarily monetary compensation in that case, but these are all different gradations of what we're not allowing. And therefore, you can derive from one type of case to another type of case. So here, the Gemara in Kiddushin clearly indicates that even if it is done inadvertently, it's still a problem. What's the case? You know, there's a sefer that is a very enjoyable little sefer. I'm in source number two, on page two. There's a little sefer that was recommended to me by my Rebbe, Herschel Schachter Shlita. Rav Schachter, you know, he had like a number of books that he really liked growing up. So, you know, I figured like if I read all this from that he liked growing up, so like maybe that'll help me, you know, become more like him. So, you know, one of them is Kesef Benifchar, which gives you, you know, a summary of like major sugyas and shas and some of the major rishonim on every single sugya. Another one is called Ara de Rabbanan. It's called The Land of the Rabbis, and it tells you about every single mitzvah and halacha, whether it's deraisa or derabanan, whether it's a machlokas, whether it's deraisa or derabanan. So where does this term ara derabanan come from? It comes from this Gemara in Kiddushin. It talks about Rav Gidol was trying to buy a certain piece of real estate, Rav Mahapik Bihari Ara, and also Rabbi Abba Zobna, and Rabbi Abba Kain came along and he bought it. So Rav Gidol was like concluding the final closing arrangements to buy the land, and before he was able to finalize the transaction, Rabbi Abba comes along and he buys it. Rav Gidol got upset. He said, hey, this isn't the way that Talmidei Chacham is supposed to act. So he complained to Rabbi Zeira, Kabbalei Rabbi Zeira. So also Rabbi Zeira, Kabbalei Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka. So Rabbi Zeira said, hey, looks like Rav Gidol was wrong. I have to find out what to do. I'll ask Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka. So Amalei. So he said, you know, Hamtena Shiel, that's Lena LaRegel. Let's wait until Rabbi Abba comes up during the regal. He'll come up to visit his Rebbe, and I'll ask him what's going on. So they asked Rabbi Abba. They said to Rabbi Abba, what's the din if you have an ani mapik b'charor, or the poor person trying to eat the cookie, and then somebody else comes and grabs it away from him? My, so I'm Lenik Ravashi. He says, oh, the second guy's called the Rasha. So he said, so why did you act like a Rasha by taking this piece of land? It's a good way to pose the question, right? So why did you act like a Rasha to take this piece of land away from poor Rav Gidol? So I'm Lenik, what have you done? I didn't know. I didn't know that Rav Gidl was trying to buy this piece of land. Nobody told me anything. I walked in. I saw a for sale sign, and they didn't take down the for sale sign yet. So I figured I'll go in and offer money, and I offered the money, and they sold me the property on the spot. I had no idea that he was in the process of finalizing the transaction. So they said, okay, hashtanami, nisve nihale mar. So they said, okay, so why don't you just go and sell it now to Rav Gidl? You bought it by mistake. Really, Rav Gidl wanted it. Sell it to him. So he said, this is the first piece of property I ever bought. I can't sell it. It's bad luck. First land you ever buy. I mean, you know, certain things take precedence. You know, you can't violate a bad luck charm or bad luck, you know, demerit on your record. So he said, it's the first land that I ever purchased, so it would be inauspicious if I would sell it. But I can give it as a gift. So I'll give it to Rav Gidl as a gift. No problem. I'll give him the land as a gift. So Gidl and Achis, so Gidl said, I don't want a gift. The Sonny Matanis, yeah. It's the principle that you're not supposed to take gifts. So if you want to live, what is the guy wants to kill me? First he takes my land, now he wants to kill me by giving me a gift. He said, I'm not taking this gift. So Rabbi Abba lo nach Islam, Rabbi Abba said, I'm not taking it because I took away a cookie from an ani ma'afik v'chavara, v'shim da'afik v'rav gidl. So neither one refused to go into the land, and they couldn't do anything about the land because Rabbi Abba couldn't sell it, and he couldn't give it away to Rav Gidl as a gift. So therefore it just stood there empty and vacant, and miskaya adro arad rabban. It was called the land of the rabbis, the vacant land that belonged to the rabbis, and nobody would enter into it. So that's the story. So from this episode, we see that even if it is inadvertent, it would still be problematic. So that's something the Bezdin has to take into account, because the defense of the yeshiva in Israel was, we're not looking to take advantage of the good name of the Das in Chicago. We never heard of the Das in Chicago. It's just Das is a good name. We figure we're teaching people Das, we're teaching them wisdom, so we'll call it Das. And had they called it something much more generic, like, you know, say Shari Torah, or, you know, some name that is used by 500 institutions throughout the world, so that would have been a stronger defense. But here, it's a very specific market and a very, very specific name. You don't have yeshivas or programs that are generally just called Das. So therefore, this was, and it wasn't Das, it was something else, but similar along those lines. So therefore, there was much more of a problem. So what we did in this case...
No,
because Rabbi Abba didn't know that Rav Gidl was negotiating the closing of the property with the owner. The owner didn't reveal that to Rabbi Abba. Abba had no idea.
Right, but they were. In the Lamaisa,
but they were, right.
They were about to close right. the deal. By that, on the other hand, there was no imminent closing the deal with whoever the Talmidim was coming to learn by the solution, right?
Right. It's not exactly parallel to Ani Amahapech B'Charora, but it's in the same universe of cases as Ani Amahapech B'Charora, where one person is taking away from somebody else that which rightfully would have gone to that other person. So there are different gradations of how that plays out. It could play out in terms of Ani Amahapech B'Charora, it could play out in terms of Dagim Diyavi Sira, it could play out in terms of somebody just benefiting from another person's goodwill without necessarily, and thereby interfering with what would have otherwise legitimately gone to that person. So it could be a different type of scenario. The Chasam Sofer in Choshen Mishpat Siman Ayin Tes points out that there are about four or five different scenarios, but they all are part of one continuum. So the principles that we formulate within that continuum are going to be generally applicable. So this is one principle, that if in whatever event you're taking away from somebody what would have rightfully gone to them, it doesn't matter if it was not malicious. It doesn't matter if it was inadvertent. The principles would still be applicable. So again, the names are different from the actual names, but essentially what we did is along the lines of the following solution. We turned to the institution in Yerushalayim and we said, look, you came second, so you shouldn't, you know, use exactly the same name because it really can cause confusion. You're both catering to the same Baal Tshuva crowd. People are not necessarily so sophisticated to tell the difference between one place that offers programming and shiurim and the other place that's a full-fledged yeshiva that's an all-day program. So instead of calling your program Das, it was still relatively early in that yeshiva's development, so where they were not dependent, shall we say, upon that name per se. It was, you know, this was something which was nipped in the bud early on. Instead of calling yourself Das, so call yourself Deot. Okay, call yourself Deot. We'll pluralize it. We'll make it in the plural form. So that's essentially what we did. We took a name where the names were identical, and we said to the second institution that you have to change the name to be in the plural form, so therefore there will be this distinction between the first place and the second place. In terms of the place that we were dealing with, I know that at least one of them is still around. I haven't checked to make sure that both of them are still around, but I know that at least one of them is still around. Hopefully both of them are still vibrant and successful. But this was how we dealt with the case, because there was a sufficiently strong argument, al pi halacha, to come to this conclusion.
How do we know that Rav Abba wasn't going with Nima Shuras in the Gemara over there? In other words, maybe he was just, you know, going above and beyond. How do we take from that Gemara that is the halacha, that is the standard that he had to return it?
Because the assumption is that the Gemara would not relate this halacha of Ani HaMahapik B'Harava Nikra Rasha so directly to Rabbi Abba that his Rebbe would pose this to him and say, Abba Mar, my Abi Haki, why you do this, if it was not a direct application of the din? It wouldn't have been approached in such a tough fashion. In fact, Rav Moshe has a tshuva, which Rav Moshe says explicitly that we see from this Gemara that it doesn't matter if it is inadvertent.
And
now,
only
yes.
It's not really actual
investment,
right?
In Ani HaMahapik B'Harava, the person is, it's Nikra Rasha, right?
I understand, but it's not like a person can be Tovei.
No, you can't be Tovei. In that particular case, you don't get damages per se. You just are called the Rasha. Most people don't want to be called the Rasha. I mean, not everybody cares, you know? Some people thought it might be a badge of honor called the Rasha. Wow, I must be a good businessman. They're calling me a Rasha, you know? But it's assumed that you don't really want to be called the Rasha. Therefore, you'll take steps to avoid being a Rasha.
When there is a tashlamin to be made, it seemed in the note even heard earlier, it's not just the loss you have to retain them. You have to share the share of the profit.
That's correct. It's because the halacha is that if you benefit from somebody else's property and you've caused them a loss, so then you have to pay for the full benefit. That's correct. Now let's take a look at the second scenario here. A local seller of a sukkah supplies in New Jersey. This was a real case that we had. Local seller of sukkah supplies suddenly faces competition from a person in the community selling similar supplies in the privacy of his home. The original seller brings a claim for Hasagas Gevul because he was the only one in this community who sold the sukkah products. You know, whether it was schach or it was mats. It was Esrogan, Lovim, Hadassim, Ravos, you know, standard sukkah supplies. But the home seller, the one who's selling from his house, he argues that the customers already have access to a plethora of competitors in other communities and in their workplaces, in New York City and elsewhere, because people drive in to work, they go to other places, and they have it, or they can even go online, and they can buy sukkah products. So it's not as if this is something which is localized, per se, that just because the other one was the only one selling locally, that means that a second person would be somehow taking away from his market share, because as it is, the market share is a shared kind of, you know, across boundary lines of an individual community. So is that considered to be a compelling enough counter-argument on the part of the person who's selling the sukkah supplies from his home? So we had this case, and one of the dayanim was actually Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who's the author of many books on economics and halakha. You may have seen some of his works. He has, you know, case studies, you know, in economics and halakha. So he came up with a particular theory in this case, but before I mention his theory, I wanted to know what you think the outcome of this case should be.
Since they all are charging 5,000% markup, we shouldn't care how much they can be.
We should just ban all of them. That's your argument.
But you're not driving the first guy out of business in any way.
No.
Yes?
I think we should look at the consumer. What is going to benefit the consumer in this case?
So you take a remigash approach. What's going to benefit the consumer? So certainly if the second person's merchandise was superior to the first person's merchandise, so then we would have the remigash argument that for that reason alone, we should allow the second person to come to the market. Let's say that his merchandise was essentially identical to the first person's merchandise.
Right, it's a fungible, like for buying a banana.
Right, and they're both selling the merchandise at exactly the same price. Okay, so let's say you have, you know, the completely homogeneous products. Yes.
What private person is basically arguing is that the gruel is international, it's not local.
That's right. So Rabbi Levine said that you have to look at the type of product that you're talking about. If it's a pizza store, so you can have a decent argument to say that, you know, if there's a pizza store which is 100 miles away, so that's not really going to be a significant option for the people in this community. Because generally speaking, you want your pizza fresh and you want your pizza to be available immediately. You know, you live in the Chicago area. So you'll consider, you know, Maine pizza, you'll consider Tel Aviv pizza, you'll consider, you know, I could go through, you know, the others. I don't, if I leave anybody out, it is not intentional. All the pizza stores are wonderful in the Chicago area. Every single kosher pizza store, I highly recommend for sure. But it's not even on somebody's radar. If there's some pizza store in Wisconsin or pizza store in Des Moines, so that's just not an option when they're, you know, ordering dinner for their children. As a general matter.
Yeah, but that's where you slice these things. I would argue that frozen pizza is as good as fresh pizza. It's more convenient because what I have to do is go to the refrigerator, open it up, put it in the oven, and I have it. Somebody else says, I want it straight from whatever store you want it.
But again...
There's where you get into a very fine line.
It's a good point. You would have to come to the conclusion that there is a different market for the frozen pizza, you know, than there is for the fresh pizza. It's eaten on different occasions. Motzei Shabbos, you go for the frozen pizza. Thursday night, you're going for the fresh pizza. There are certain market patterns.
Yeah, but I'll make it even different. One pizza shop, you have to go there to pick it up. The other one delivers it. Are those two different products?
Those might be as well, because we've dealt with those types of distinctions in Hasagas Gavul cases. But certainly, if the pizza is in some different geographical location, it doesn't pose the same sort of threat. However, when you are dealing with the type of products which people often order, you know, weeks ahead of time, and they have the chance to sample a larger geographical region, so it's a much more difficult to claim that just because somebody is the only one selling those products in his geographical region, that he's the only act in town. Particularly if you live in a community where people are very, very mobile and where people work in different places and they frequently travel to other places and they have children and relatives that they visit regularly in other places. So he felt that where a certain type of product is not limited within a particular geographical region, then it's much more difficult for somebody to claim that their market share is being taken away. And it was on that basis that he felt that the ruling in this particular case should be in favor of the second person who was opening up the shop within his own home. And that was the ruling of the Beis Din in that particular case.
So yes. You increase the end of custom, I mean, when you're going from local to international, it's simply concentric circles of increasing customer base. So you could reduce the question and say, even if it wasn't international, at what point do we consider the end of customers increasing? A community grows. So because of Hasagas Gavul, do I have to let this person who was a one-man business now become a 10-man business? Or because the number of customers increase because the community is larger, does that allow room for another business anyway?
Right, that's the question of, are we building more populous and higher volume business districts by allowing more competitors into a particular region? And if it's felt that this is actually good for the health of the region, for the volume of business in the region, and for more people moving into the region, so that also is a relevant consideration from the standpoint of the business, because that could bode well for both of the stores, and the argument can be that as long as they are savvy business people and they do a good job in marketing their product, nobody's going to end up losing out. Whereas a person can never really advance a Hasagas Gavul claim on the basis of saying, well, I'm not a good business person, and therefore I want to keep out, you know, all the business and all the growth and development within the community, because ultimately I'm not going to make it because I'm just not a good business person. If a person really had, if they would be a good business person, then they would survive the growth of the market, and they would even flourish in the growth of the market. So we don't find that Hasagas Gavul rules require providing protection for people who are not savvy. That's the Gemara that says that if I have two people who are already in business and one person wants to give treats to the kids in order to draw them towards his supermarket, that the other supermarket owner can't stop him because he could say, look, I'm giving out the walnuts, you give out the almonds, right? I'm giving out the Agosi bars, you give out the Hershey bars or whatever. So since everybody, every business person has the opportunity to compete in that fashion. It's not fair for one to stop the other just because he doesn't want to engage in the sound and customary business practices that would typically advance somebody's business. So what I'd like to do next time is to talk about a different aspect of the Tosfos that quotes the Rabbeinu Meir, and that is the aspect of the Tosfos that talks about individuals who are professionals taking away business from each other, specifically in a school context. If you have a school that wants to hire away a well-respected teacher from another school, or if you have a Rebbe who wants to teach in a particular yeshiva, but it would require taking a job away from an existing Rebbe, what are the efforts that one is allowed to engage in? And I would add to that question two other scenarios, which would be in terms of taking away customers. Can one school take away students from another school if they feel that they want to increase their student population and recruit students away from another school? And to what degree, once we're on that subject, just to complete, you know, that subject, to talk about our teachers themselves restricted in terms of their movement, to be concerned about the future of their schools, that if they've already been fired by one school, to not leave that school in the middle of an employment contract if they decide that on their own, that they would rather switch to a different school in the middle of their contract. So I would like, based on using Tosfos on Daf Nun Tes as a launching pad, because Tosfos discusses the first two of those scenarios, I'd like to discuss all of those scenarios next time, Mirz Hashem, when we meet 3 weeks from today.
Thank you. Okay.